We're reading from Proverbs 31, verses 10 to 31, and this is an epilogue. A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies. Her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. She brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. She is like the merchant ships, bringing her food from afar. She gets up while it is still dark. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. She sees that her trading is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. In her hand, she holds the distaff and grasps the spindle with her fingers. She opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. When it snows, she has no fear for her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet. She makes coverings for her bed. She is clothed in fine linen and purple. Her husband is respected at the city gate, where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, and supplies the merchants with sashes. She is clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at the days to come. She speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the reward she has earned, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate. Thanks be to God for his word.
Once upon a time, there was a king who had three sons, Alexander, Julius, and Joseph. Alexander was the most handsome man in the entire realm. One look from him could make the ladies weak at the knees. Julius was the strongest man in the kingdom. He could wrestle a bull, no problems. But Joseph wasn't much of anything, really. He spent most of his time looking after the king's sheep. And as so often happens in these stories, the king sent them on a quest to find who would be king after him. He set them a challenge to go out and find the most wonderful creature in the realm, the creature that best represented what it meant to be a king. And so the nation held their breath as the three of them set out on the quest. It would be a month before the first one would return. Alexander returned and before the court revealed his creature, pulling back a golden cloth. He revealed the most astonishing peacock. The ladies gasped. The feathers a deep midnight blue, the tail feather is covered in gems. With this by my side, I will make the realm the most beautiful of nations, sung Alexander. All were impressed and thought, surely he's won. That is until a month later, Julius swaggered in, a little scratched, a little scarred, but dragging behind him the mightiest of lions that you have ever seen. The ladies squealed at the sight, and with a roar and a pounce, he jumped onto the peacock and gobbled it up. With this by my side, I will make this nation the strongest the world has ever seen, boasted Julius. It seemed an outright victory. As the days passed, the people could talk of little else other than the lion. They'd quite forgotten that Joseph was still out there. That is, until another month had passed. 3 months had gone before Joseph returned, looking quite refreshed, really. "Oh, I haven't been travelling," he said. "I've just been in the next valley, really. And from there, I've brought back the wisest of creatures in the entire land." Joseph went out of the throne room and came back, leading by the hand a shepherd girl, still covered in the soil of the land. "With Sophia by my side, I will rule the nation with wisdom." At this, some of the ladies fainted. A shepherd girl? Just then, Julius's lion sprung its leash and prowled in, lunging towards Sophia. She stood unmoving. She didn't run. She didn't turn, but reached out and began to smooth down his mane. She whispered softly in his ear and tickled underneath his chin. The mighty lion turned into a kitten, sprawling on the floor in delight. How Julius blushed, how the nation laughed. Joseph had bested them all. 8 days later, they were married and crowned. King Joseph and his noble wife, Queen Sophia. The story isn't my own. It's taken from the book Wise Words, but it gets us to the heart of Proverbs 31. In verse 10, it says, "A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies." And that immediately raises two questions for us. Firstly, what is it that makes a good wife? And secondly, will we value that more than rubies? Let's take our first question first. What makes a good wife? If we take a moment to think about it, there are lots of answers that people would give. What makes a good wife in 2020 Britain? Well, the feminist would say that the good wife doesn't even need to be married. She should be a career woman, independently making her own way in the world. The chauvinist would disagree, would say, well, the good wife will stay in the kitchen. The romantic would search for someone to walk along sunset beaches with and to share all of life's moments together. Whereas the teenage boy, and let's be honest, even the grown man, tragically has now grown up in a culture where 50 Shades of Grey has become an international bestseller. What makes a good wife for them is a willingness to do whatever pleases me in the bedroom. I don't think Proverbs 31 could be more countercultural if it had tried to be. It paints for us a far more beautiful picture. What makes the good wife? Well, looking at verses 13 to 18, we'd have to start by saying it's hard work. She is willing, joyful, even to work, verse 13. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. She works hard, verse 15. She gets up while it's still night. She provides food for her family and portions for her female servants. Whether that's food, portions of food, or portions of work, it could be either. She's engaged in responsible work, a real entrepreneur, verse 16. She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. Work that is beneficial to her household. Verse 40, she is like a merchant ship bringing her food from afar. The table that she keeps is full of rich and tasty fare. This is not just food, this is M&S food. Again in verse 18, she sees that her trading is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. I don't think that means that she's burning the midnight oil. That would be a little bit unwise, wouldn't it? Her lamp just means her profitability. And that profitability doesn't come and go. It is here to stay. It burns brightly at all times. But we need to be careful here before we draw our conclusions. You might hear the feminists cheer at this chapter and say, well, look, here's a businesswoman capable of holding her own in the workforce. And that's partially true. But But you might also hear the chauvinist cheer and say, well, here is a woman engaged in lots of domestic chores. The truth is that work and home were far more intertwined in the ancient Near East than they are today. And it's a false divide to argue for either, really. Really, the question it wants us to ask isn't what is she doing, but why is she doing what she is? Verses 20 to 27 tell us. It's not to assert her independence. It's certainly not because she's been told to. Not for her own private benefit. She does it because of the relationships that she finds herself in. She blesses the poor with the money that she's earned in verse 20. She opens her arms to the poor and extends her hand to the needy. She blesses her family with the security that her work provides in 21. When it snows, she has no fear for her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet. She blesses her husband. He's free from concern and scorn because of her work in verse 23. Her husband is respected at the city gate, where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. Her work enables him to serve in the community in that particular way. But more than that, she blesses the community herself by her words of wisdom. Verse 26, she speaks with wisdom and faithful instruction is on her tongue. She's not necessarily a mousy type. She has a tongue in her mouth, a brain in her head, and she's willing to use it. She offers godly advice to her children and to those who are around her, even at times to her husband. Now, Proverbs 31 can sometimes be a difficult chapter to hear, an intimidating chapter for women. The noble wife is like that one girl at school that seems to have it all, that seems and makes everyone else a little bit insecure. She's got brains, she's got looks, she's got charm, and by some quirk of science seems to never have any spots. She can be quite intimidating. It is an exhausting portrait of a wife that knits more cardigans than M&S, that does more charity work than Mother Teresa, and never seems to take a day off or ever get tired. Each verse in 10 to 31 starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. This, if you will, is the A to Z of the good wife. And we'd rightly say, well, Joel, that's just not me. I can't do all that stuff. I can't run a small business. I can't even knit. But this chapter isn't here to give us a to-do list for every wife. The next time that we meet someone who's described as a wife of noble character in this way is when we come across Ruth in the Bible. Now, it's exceedingly unlikely that Ruth spent her time spinning wool or selling produce. She doesn't have servants to tell what to do, and she doesn't have a field that she can plant. But she fulfills this character by gleaning in the fields, in order to be a blessing to her mother-in-law Naomi. What the passage is commending is an attitude that drives all of her work. It is a self-sacrificing attitude on the behalf of others that's being commended here. A diligent work that blesses others in all its varieties and forms. The wife is willing to forfeit the comfort of her bed in the morning to get up and look after her family, willing to sacrifice precious time and resources to bless the poor. We're not to despise the wife that stays at home to instruct her children in the way of the Lord. We're not to despise the woman that works in order to have enough to give to others. What matters is how we serve in the relationships and the situation that we find ourselves in. That can still be pretty intimidating. If we're honest, we know that we should be doing this, but we still find it hard. How does the wife of noble character do it? Look down at verse 30. The engine room of this passage and the beating heart of this woman. Verse 30. Charm is deceptive, and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Here is the engine room of the woman, the fear of the Lord. If you get that in place, the rest will flow from it. Guard your heart, for everything you do flows out from it. Chapter 31 ends where chapter 1 had started. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. What it's saying is that this is what it will look like if we read Proverbs and put it into practice. If we've read it and understood it, it's not an academic book. Proverbs works itself out in the mundane chores of everyday life and the work of our hands. It is wisdom for life. The fear of the Lord leads to a willingness to serve others in the relationships in which we find ourselves. As we said, with work, the wise person is willing to disadvantage themselves for the sake of the community, whereas the foolish person is only willing to disadvantage the community for the sake of themselves. And that goes for men as well as for women. In the earlier part of the chapter, we came across King Lemuel, who's held to an equally high standard. Well, he's to abstain from selfish vices which destroy the poor. Instead, he's to give up his rights in order to care for the poor and the needy and those around him. It's a striking picture of leadership to look up to. I think one of the biggest challenges that Proverbs has for us today is seeing ourselves not just as individual units. We're involved in a dense web of relationships, and how we behave impacts not just on ourselves, but impacts on all those around us. Proverbs wants us to locate us into a community and to help us operate in a world in a way that doesn't just benefit ourselves, but benefits the community as a whole. Proverbs is about enculturation, not just telling us what we should be as individuals, but how we should operate as a group. We could say how we should operate as a church. And what a brilliant community it would be if we took Proverbs to heart. Let's move on to our second question. Verse 10 says that such a woman is worth far more than rubies, which prods us to ask the question, well, what do we value? Do we really value this more than rubies? We often fall into thinking that Proverbs 31 was just written for women, a great chapter to do at a woman's convention. But that's not really true. It was written to a son. It was written to King Lemuel. This isn't a wife seeking excellence. This is someone else seeking excellence in a wife. And not so that he can critique her, but so that he can praise her. And just look at verses 28. Her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also is, and he praises her. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. Here is the application of the passage. It is to be praise. Children are to praise this sort of mother. A husband is to praise this sort of wife. Verse 29 is incredible. Verse 10 had described the wife of noble character as exceedingly rare. Part of her scarcity adds to her value. She's more scarce than rubies. But then she's described as commonplace in verse 29. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. That's the equivalent of saying that she's one in 8 billion. He shows her appreciation for her, and crucially, in verse 11, he trusts her as well. I don't know how effusive you are in the praise of your wife, but wouldn't it be a nice idea to send her a card, not just on a birthday, not just on Valentine's Day, but in order to encourage her and to praise her? It doesn't stop there, though, does it? It's not just the family that are to praise her. The whole community is drawn into that praise in verse 31. honour her for all that her hands have done, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate. The city gate is where the elders used to sit, the ones who represented the community. And this then is the equivalent of an award ceremony. Here is the one that we are going to put on a pedestal. Here's the one that we're going to encourage everyone to emulate. But it's worth noting again what it is she's praised for. Verse 30. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. That's not saying that charm is pointless and that we can just walk around being obnoxious to everyone. We all know, though, don't we, that charm can be deceiving. Plenty of people can turn on the charm in order to get what they want. It's not saying that beauty is to be denied, but rather beauty is fleeting. Beauty is vain. It's the same word used in Ecclesiastes. It's vapour, mist, ephemeral. Like when you breathe out in a cold day, the vapour is there 1 minute and it's gone the next. Just so with beauty, it's there 1 minute, then you look in the mirror and you're old and wrinkled and worn. Instead, she is to be praised for her fear of the Lord. Now, you might have noticed that our culture has a way to go on this one. Think about it. What is it that gets the most attention in magazines? Those who are charming? Certainly. Those who are beautiful? Absolutely. Those who fear the Lord? Maybe not. Less so. And that forms a vicious circle. If we praise those who are stick thin, then girls will want to emulate that and to follow that in order to receive that praise. That in part is why we have such problems with anorexia and bulimia. Likewise with charm. If we as men only seek out those that are charming, then you can bet our young girls will learn to be charming, sometimes in deceptive ways. But what's left out in the cold is a fear of the Lord. And we're culpable because we do not praise that which is truly praiseworthy. By omission, we mislead our younger generation. So let me take the time to speak to three separate groups. Firstly, let me speak to husbands, men, to you. If we had a pie chart of your praise, what do you praise in your wife? Is it her beauty, her charms, or her godliness? This has to be part of Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wife just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word. At least part of that is going to mean encouraging her godliness with praise. Thinking about one example of that, I love my wife Lucy dearly, and I think she's beautiful and I think she's charming as well. But when it comes to praising her for godliness, if you've known Lucy for a while, you might know that she loves to encourage people by giving them cake. She has a ministry of baking. But I have to confess that when she does that, my tendency isn't to praise her for it. My tendency is more to grumble that we've run out of cake and that she's given all my cake away, which should not be. But what opportunities do you have to praise your wife for godliness? Next up, parents. Are we setting a godly example? Are we setting godly examples before the eyes of our sons and daughters? We'll quite happily buy them the latest Disney movie with princes and princesses in it. But have we ever given them a Christian biography? We could sit down and read it with them. We could point out to them when other church members are being really godly and wise and say, wouldn't that be a great example to follow? Thirdly, to those who are looking for a wife or a husband. What are you going to value in a prospective partner? Just a little bit of gentle advice. The person that you're looking for might not be found drawing all the attention on the dance floor. They might be found hoovering the church floor after Oasis. Just a little advert there. As we come back to church, we will need a cleaning team to clean the church. If you build a relationship on something as fleeting as looks or fleeting as charm, I wouldn't give the marriage more than a few years. A younger, sleeker model always comes along. But there's something more to this chapter, something that we've not looked at. Some of the language in here is really quite heroic. She sounds almost like Wonder Woman. Verse 10, she could be described as the wife of valour. Verse 15 could more literally read, she brings in prey for her house. With bared arms, strong for the task, she laughs at the future like a hero who's just defeated an enemy. The wife sets an impossible standard that it would be hard to expect anyone to live up to. She's worth far more than rubies. Does that remind you of anyone? We came across it in chapter 3. Verse 13, blessed are those who find wisdom, those who gain understanding. Verse 15, she is more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. The one you're looking to marry isn't this wife. The one that you should marry is Lady Wisdom. There was a little play on words in our story at the beginning. The Greek word for wisdom is Sophia. Joseph marries Wisdom. She is the wife who will share his rule. At the end of Proverbs, we have one final call to keep on listening to Wisdom. Marry her. Just like a wife, she is to be the person that we spend our days with. She's to be there when we wake up and there when we go to bed. She's to be there when we're young and when we're old as well. When we have the decision to make, we're to sit down and to discuss it with her, to discuss it with Lady Wisdom. When we've gone wrong, it's her hand which is there to guide us back onto the straight path. She is the friend who is to be close enough to rebuke us. Lady Wisdom is the only one that can fulfill verse 12. She brings him good and not harm all the days of her life. But we know, don't we? We ought to know by now that we've seen this every week, that when we're talking about wisdom, really what we're talking about is Jesus. Lady Wisdom is a picture of Jesus. What she personifies, Jesus would embody, would live out and would teach. Jesus is the wisest of friends who leads us towards life. Jesus is the one who always speaks with gentle breath. Jesus is the wise decision maker who submits his plans to God. Jesus is the worker who entered poverty so that we could become rich. When we read Proverbs, we're reading about Jesus. He's the wise teacher, the one who we are to listen to above all. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like the wise man who built his house on the rock. Really, we should amend our summary of Proverbs from living in God's world, God's way, to living in Jesus' world, Jesus' way. But not only that, when we talk about wisdom, we are talking about the gospel. We're talking about the cross. In 1 Corinthians, it says, Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but for those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Proverbs helps us to understand the cross. This week we've seen an example of self-sacrificial work that blesses others. Doesn't that remind you of anyone? Doesn't that remind you of an event? It's a picture of Jesus' self-giving life, his life-giving death that brings great blessing to others. So two final challenges as we finish Proverbs. If you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, don't you want to listen? Don't you want to find out more about him? We're all looking for answers to that great question. How do I live the good life? What does it mean to live the best life, not just now, but in light of the future, in light of eternity? There are plenty of people out there who will tell you a path to walk on. Some of them will look pleasing and pleasurable in the short term. We've been warned about those. Won't you listen to the one who provides what he promises, who promises to navigate you towards life, a life of fulfillment, true blessing beyond riches, both now and forevermore? Won't you follow Christ? Won't you accept him as your saviour? And if you are a Christian, doesn't this make you love Jesus more? As you see how wise he is, he stands in a sharp contrast to us at times. When we're foolish, he is wise. Doesn't Proverbs make you ache to be more like him? Every week we've seen that this isn't just wisdom for Old Testament believers. It lands in the New Testament as well. It shows us what it's like to follow Jesus Christ, to be more like Jesus Christ. And seeing that, doesn't that just draw out your praise? Many people do noble things, but Christ surpasses them all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but the man who feared the Lord is to be praised. Honour him for all that his hands have done, and let his work bring him praise in the city gate.